Hello, everybody. Chris Martinson here. And today we're going to be talking about finance and economics as part of Finance U. Remember, anything that you see in this video and all resources available at our websites or affiliated websites are not intended as or construed as financial advice. This is for educational purposes. Remember, if you have a financial decision, please consult a financial professional. We are not attorneys. We're not CPAs. We are not financial managers. As well, we do our best to be accurate, and everything we represent is as accurate as we know it to be. Now, let's turn to our program.
I think this is just simply herd psychology, you know, desperation, and a lot of gambling on the parts of a lot of market participants, and unknown gambling on the large majority of market participants that have just been caught, throw it in an unmanaged passive index and ride it.
Hello, everyone. Chris Martinson here of Peak Prosperity with another edition of Finance U, and back with Paul Kiker. Hey, Paul, how are you today?
Hi, Chris. I'm doing great. Good to see you.
I'm really excited for this talk. So much going on. But before we really get started with like the data and stuff like that, Paul, you want to know, this is a very typical conversation I'm having now. So in my business, I talk to people all the time, all different strata. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. Everybody's sort of awake, I guess. So maybe a little selection bias, but here's a call. Very typical. Chris, I'm pretty sure something bad is coming and I don't know what it is. Or Chris, I think something's coming, but my wife, who I really trust, who's more intuitive than I am, is yelling at me that we got to start getting more prepared. So it's this vibe. I don't know what to do with it. I'm just offering it out there. I know you talk to a lot of people as well. I just wanted to bounce that off you. See if you're having conversations like that too.
No, actually, I'm having a lot of conversations that way, not only on a national level, but even on a local level. So, You know, one of the things that the unbelievably intelligent followers that you have through Peak Prosperity, like, I mean that seriously. I expect them to understand some of the issues that are taking place, right? Because they've followed you. You do a great job as an information scout and notifying them.
Thank you.
On the local level and our footprint in the North Georgia mountains, that's more of a representation, even down to Atlanta, of kind of what the average American is facing, because there's a lot of people that just don't want to know or don't know that they need to know yet. But it's interesting you bring that up, because Holly and I were talking just a couple of days ago, my wife Holly, about there's a sense of unease that people are feeling. They're feeling it in their budgets. They're feeling it in the grocery store. They're feeling it across the board, and it just doesn't make sense to them. And I'm actually getting a lot of phone calls from local clients that I've tried to open their eyes to what's taking place, and they're like, I'm ready to have that conversation now. So this is something that I believe is common across the nation right now. The average person just doesn't know how to put their finger on it. Even those of us that are paying attention to things like myself, I don't know how to put my finger on that anxiety or that guillotine that it feels like, you know, making the hair on the back of your neck stand up. But there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it really doesn't help that we have so many weird things happening all at once. It's almost too much to keep track of at this point in time. You know, just this week, I've had interviews with lawyers who are having these bizarre cases where the judiciary seems to be off the trails of normal decency, where all the work that I did tracking the migrants and working through the migrant issue, not immigration, migrants, and still talking with those people, crazy stuff happening there, talking to people who are inside some of the organizations, and they're very unhappy with how things are. And it just, nobody feels like they have agency to do much about anything. So I guess we're all just sort of like preparing as best we can.
Correct. Well, and getting, I think there's, sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's just, I was going to say, we're just getting ready for something, but we don't know what it is. And that makes it really hard to plan, you know, is the hard part.
It does. Well, and I think also there's a recognition that it seems that we don't necessarily have a rule of law anymore. Okay. And I was surprised, because, you know, Dave Ramsey does phenomenal work in what he does as far as helping people budget and things of that nature. But even he went on a rant recently that basically this is upside down world. You know, what has always been right is not necessarily considered right anymore. So, you know, and it doesn't feel like that feels like there's a different set of justice. There's rules for the elite that don't apply to the average individual. Right. So I've actually heard a couple of people say, do we even have the rule of law anymore in their business world of some of the thing that they're seeing take place and some of the double standards that are taking place in the political process. And it's heartbreaking. Now I notice those things, but that's not where I spend a whole lot of time where I can talk a lot about what they're mentioning, but that's things that comments people are making to me that, that I don't know that I've heard in 26 years of working with individuals before this.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know how we got here this quickly, but here we are. And, I'm curious, and I want to talk to you about Japan. I want to talk about markets. I want to get into some financial stuff, some economic stuff with you. But before we do, I'm just curious, how do you, like, do you have any, anonymize them? I know you have to do that, but do you have any cases of how you're helping people? I mean, I don't know how you do it. How do you coach somebody in this environment with, I know you always have to make decisions with imperfect information, but this is upside down information, you know?
Right.
It's crazy.
Right. I'll tell you, quite frankly, the more our eyes are open to what's taking place and the more you understand history, the harder it is. But the reality is one thing is, Chris, and this is the conversation I have with a lot of people, just, you know, you may disagree with me. No, you may agree with me on this, but in 2007, 2008, my eyes were open to, by God's grace, we were running a risk managed strategy. So we were able to guide our clients through that well. I didn't really understand the importance of it. It just made sense to me because once you get into retirement and you're in a distribution phase, right? If you have a $1 million portfolio and you take a 50% decline, well, now you got a $500,000 portfolio. And if you're taking $50,000 a year in income off of it, you're never going to recover that. So that to me made sense. And as being a fiduciary and helping people recognize the risks, that's what drove me to a risk managed strategy. I didn't want somebody getting wiped out on my watch. After seeing what happened in 08 and my eyes that were open kind of prior to that, because you were already educating people and warning, you know, I think, what is it you put out yesterday about kind of your outlay in the future? And you've been spot on as far as the things that are happening. And so from that point forward, you know, I didn't think that we would be able to make it this far. I didn't think that our leaders would be able to cross all of these boundaries, you know, and essentially do whatever it takes and to heck with the consequences from a long-term standpoint to be able to make it this far. So I keep bringing people back. Look, I know you see these things, but we don't know if it's 5 months in the future, 5 years in the future, or 10 years, right? And you've got to be able to live. So we need to do some planning. Let's get in there. Let's do that planning to find out how many assets you need set aside, dedicated to providing the income that you need in retirement based on the income that you need. And then if you have excess, right, if there's X amount of dollars left over, then we can really build in those safety nets because we've got to be able to help people be prudent with the assets that they have. So once I explain that, people come back to it. So here's the results. And it's so powerful because in our industry, too many advisors are just asset gatherers, right? They want to get out there and say, hey, I want to gather your assets. You know, hey, you want to retire? Awesome. How much money you got? This is how much income that it can pay you. They don't talk about inflation. They talk about their portfolio strategies. Hey, let's go golfing together. They build the relationships. They're asset gatherers and salespeople. What our responsibility to do is help people develop a plan and show them the risks that they're going to face in retirement and stress test those situations so that they're able to make decisions quicker than the average person when they get there. And I can't tell you how often I run into somebody that says, hey, you know, I'm coming to get a second opinion from you. I've got a couple of friends that work with you. You've done a good job for them. You know, all these advisors told me that it's okay for me to retire. And then when I run a plan for them based on the income that they need, it's a completely different picture. So a couple of things. One of the things I ask people before we get into the planning process is how much after-tax income do you need on a monthly basis to live the lifestyle that you're living in retirement? Consistently, Chris, since 2007 that we've been using this particular program, 2007, 2009, somewhere around there, people don't know that answer. right? They think, here's how much assets I have. How much income can you generate for me off of that? That's the wrong way to go about it in retirement. We need to know how much you need on an after-tax basis. So two scenarios. One, a couple answered that, but because I was the first that had asked them that question, even with the people that they're working with, from the time I got the information, ran the plan, and we get together, these numbers aren't exact, but their income needs had increased from, let's say, $100,000 a year to $130,000. So they said, I got to thinking about it really hard, and I need more income to live on than what I initially thought. Like, I really didn't realize that that's how much it is. Well, the goal was to retire in 2 years, essentially. So the sad part about my job from time to time, but it's the crucial part of my job is to tell people the truth of their situation and be able to demonstrate that, right? We have an unknowable future, but we can take the assets that they have today, talk about the risks. So we get done with the plan, and essentially in all of the historical analysis that we looked at, 7 in 10 times they would have failed. They would have outlived their money. Okay. Now you can imagine the shock, right? Because you've got this goal painted. But I asked the question, I said, okay, what would you rather do? Would you rather work longer or would you rather take less income? And after some serious thought, they said, well, we would rather work longer than to reduce our lifestyle dramatically. So by the end of that first planning meeting, I was able to give the outline of a plan that says, yeah, you might have to work, you know, from instead of 62, 63 to 67, 68. But, you know, now you've got a 95% probability of success. The only thing that would have taken you out would have been a major decline in the Great Depression. And if you've got a risk managed strategy, that can reduce the probability of that causing some problems. So that was one scenario. They were so grateful, messaged the next day and said, hey, you're the first person that we've talked to that's actually had this kind of conversation with us. And we've talked to a lot of advisors in the industry. And of course, I'm thinking, you know, because our industry is designed to gather assets, you know, let's get it in. The second scenario, which is these are a whole lot more fun to begin with, right? So I ran into somebody here not too long ago. They've done a good job saving. They lived their life sacrificing. They've made a lot of sacrifices and they've been very good stewards of the resources that they have. So they have an income level, let's just say it's $60,000 a year, that the budget that they're set on, and they're enjoying their lifestyle there, right? Because they're already retired. But once I was able to stress test them against, you know, 3.5%, 5.5%, 7.5% inflation, I'm like, okay, you can actually live on a lot more than that. And they were so relieved because, you know, their initial thought was like, look, you know, we thought that might be the case, but I didn't have any way of demonstrating it. And I didn't have any way of having some evidence of that was the case. And again, in our industry, there's an incentive to hold on to those assets. Cause if they're not going out the door, right, you've got more assets under management, more fees, things of that nature. So that's the weakness in our industry. Now, there are a lot of really good advisors out there on the modern portfolio theory that compare. Okay, I'm not saying that there's bad advisors, but there's a fault in our industry. Just like the FLCCC is able to demonstrate clearly that there's a fault in the healthcare industry that doesn't necessarily serve the client in the manner that they most need to be served because of that conflict of interest. And of course, I, you know, don't get me wrong. We're compensated of the fees of the asset that we manage or hourly, depending upon the client circumstance, mostly on the fees. So, you know, yes, there's an incentive there. That's why you disclose those fees and you talk about it. But the planning is able to demonstrate to a client where they need to be, stress test for the future and say, hey, you can stay this conservative allocation. But if we get 5.5% sustained or 7.5% inflation, this is what you need to do in your portfolio allocation to combat against that. So I love it. It's kind of sitting down doing the plan with people from time to time. And I have people that'll push back and they'll be like, well, I just want you to manage assets. And I'm like, well, we can do that, but you don't go to a doctor and ask them to treat you for something without looking at your blood work or your medical history. So I need to see that so that I can get a snapshot of your situation and then, you know, show you the options that you have to be able to accomplish your goals or manage the resources you have prudently.
That's why I love working with you, Paul, because you're what obviously the right thing to do. So you are, you know, there's a difference between a job and a vocation, right? If you're mm-hmm. a job, somebody comes in, you write a prescription for an SSRI and send them out in 5 minutes, you know?
Yes.
If it's your vocation, you find out what the underlying thing is because you know they've got a set of symptoms, you're going to figure it out, right? So I see you take this as a vocation, and that's a great thing. I think people are hungry for that. I know I am. I'm ready to be able to trust people who are going to be doing the right things, you know, but it's just, it's not how things, you know, are, these days, unfortunately, all too much.
No.
Right. So,
and unfortunately, and everything in our society drives us in that direction, right? Like I really enjoy X, for example, to keep up with information, but I don't engage a lot. And I shop Facebook Marketplace to see what's for sale locally. And I see what's going on, but I don't engage a lot. Right.
Yeah.
Because the problem is, you know, and I think so much of our society, it's like, hey, this is the lifestyle you should be living. And no matter where you are, you see somebody who's living a greater lifestyle. Billionaires always got somebody that's, you know, got more billions than they do. You know, and if you're the number one guy in the world, then, you know, somebody's looking to knock you off of that position. So, unfortunately, too much of our society incentive is driven by, I want to make as much as I possibly can. And they see people as a stepping stone, where there was a period of time in the past and what our profession should be, this is what you do. If I can make your life better, if I can do a good job for you and help you choose the path of wisdom, everything else will take care of itself. And, you know, and that's one of the things why now we do have some kind of minimums in there, but basically we serve people, not money. And that's why we built the infrastructure in place to be able to serve less complicated situations, to be able to help people, whether it's a really complicated situation, those are the ones I tend to work with the most, but the less complicated situations, we can serve them and know that they've got a good plan in place and they're going to get good service. And, you know, cause we want to control the things that we can control. Cause I can't control what our government leaders do. The only thing we can do is adapt our asset management style to whatever wrenches they try to throw in the system.
Yep. Yep. All right. Before I turn to Japan, if anybody wants to set up a consult with Paul and his amazing team, just go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, a very simple form, sends out an email and you'll be contacted. So that's the process so far. It's been working pretty smoothly. I'd say we got a good thing going here. So, let me turn to this. We're going to talk about Japan now. Is that okay?
Oh, absolutely. Big deal, actually.
It is a big deal. So, I said Japan is cooked, but this is really about tracking the everything bubble. I'm not the only person using that language now. But this is a big deal. The Bank of Japan, just the other day, they hiked rates. They hiked rates the first time in 17 years and did something called abolishing yield curve control. Sounds a little wonky, but what they're trying to do or have been doing, and I guess they're killing this as an idea, yield curve. The yield curve is the difference between what you're paying on 28-day paper, 1-year paper, 2-year, 3-year, 4-year, 5-year, that there's a curve of yields, right? And so they're controlling that whole curve, you know, thinking masters of the universe, we can just dictate the price of money at any point in time, you know, it's good things happen. So this is crazy. Look, this is, let me get my little laser pointer out, I guess. This was the last time they hiked here in 2007. Right? That was a quarter point, you know, just to get the scale here. They went from 0.25 to 0.5 and that was it. You know, that's astonishing to me. Then down. And then it's been negative for this whole time. And now here it is, the new range, 0 to 0.1%. This is on 10 years, right? This is their, is this 10 years? Is this 10 years? This must be the short end. Which end of this is this? I can't tell because they have their yield curve control has been so flat. You know, when we talk about the Fed, they're always talking about the short-term rate, you know, the overnight rate, but what are they setting here on this policy? I'd have to look that up. Do you know offhand?
You know, I don't know offhand. It's my understanding it's the short-term policy. I don't think it's the 10-year, but I didn't.
Okay.
I glanced over that when I was.
No, it must be short-term because the 10-year last I saw was already up at like 0.8 or 0.9 or something. So yeah, this is the overnight rate. Anyway, it's been negative. What does negative money mean? Well, that means if you earn, produce value, save, they're going to destroy that value for you. I don't even know what negative interest means. It means your money has less than no value over time. It's a bizarre concept. But I think they're behind the curve, Paul, because this is, we just had this report just the other day that Japan had a blowout wage result, largest pay hike in 30 years. This is a 5.3% year over year increase, which you have to go back to like the 90s to see something like that. So if they're doing this because they realize they have to start trying to control inflation, they are way behind the curve on this. I'm sorry to tell them, but 0.0 to 0.1% is not going to get the job done. This is not going to happen. So the rest of the context is looking longer. This is the last time they had wage hikes way back up there in the 90s, where they had interest rates, if you can believe it, of, 5-6%, any rate, I want to pay attention to this little Mesa right here. That's 07. That's 2007, where they took it from basically zero all the way up to 0.5% and then had to immediately retreat, just remember that 07. We'll talk about that in a second. Immediately, this is the Japanese yen. This is it getting weaker the higher it goes. This is in USD terms. They've been holding it hard under the 150 mark here. Mm-hmm. Notably here in November, where we saw like stocks and everything going up like crazy, this is when the yen was also being driven down, perhaps unrelated, maybe not. But we can see here it is now back at its all-time weakest. And this is all-time weakest for 2-3 decades now. This is what's called offshore yen, again, getting weaker as it goes this way. This is comparing it against the yuan, the Chinese yuan. And now it hasn't been this weak against the yuan, I don't know, ever, potentially, but very long time. And the 2007 matters because the last time the Bank of Japan tightened in 2007, we also call that the Great Financial Crisis. Yeah. Just in case, could be unrelated, could be related. So here we are tightening again after this, crazy run, who knows? Mm-hmm. So against all of that, this is gold in Japanese yen terms. And this is this beautiful, very long-term cup, handle, and explosion. This is the price of gold in yen. Obviously, it isn't this dramatic in dollars, but it's kind of cap-constrained in dollars as much as they can, but not in other currencies. So before we go any further, that's what I'm seeing in the yen. And I actually think this is a big deal. What are you making of it?
I think it's a big deal too. And of course, Edward Dowd tweeted that he believes that this could potentially be the fuse that lit the fuse to cause another global financial crisis. And the biggest reason, he had his own reasons in there and I didn't retain them specifically to memory, but being the first time in 17 years, I mean, Japanese investors have had to send their capital all over the world because negative interest rates means that I'm going to put it in the bank. And I'm going to pay you to hold my dollars, right? So I'm going to give you $100,000. Let's say, just to keep math simple, if it's a percent a year negative rate, in 10 years, you're going to pay me $90,000 back just to hold my capital, okay? But the bank's going to be able to go out and do what they want to do with it. Well, theoretically, I guess that's better than holding it home under the mattress because somebody could break in the house or it could burn down. But that's what they're doing. So Japanese investors have looked around the world and said, okay, we need to send our dollars elsewhere because we can earn a greater rate of return somewhere else. So for example, somewhere in the neighborhood of Japanese investors, as big time capital exporters, I don't know what it is for other countries, but they've got north of $1 trillion in treasuries that are invested in the United States, which is foreign money, they have sent to the United States. So as a Japanese investor, you've bought foreign U.S. treasuries, okay? So that's because they didn't have any other alternative. Well, you can imagine loaning money. If you go buy a Kubota tractor, they've always had interest rates that are far better than anybody else if you borrow something because they're better off to send those funds over here. The question is, if with that greater rise in earnings and wages increase, if they're behind the curve and they have to play catch up, what happens with all those dollars that have been sent in the foreign markets by Japanese investors when it becomes more attractive or just as attractive to come back home and remove that currency volatility risk? So I agree. Edward's right. I believe this is a big deal. It surprised me that the yen weakened upon the news. But you know, there's times where we've seen the markets go up initially on the Fed rate, you know, Fed news, and then they turn and go down following. So you can't trust the initial reaction to begin with, but this is a big deal. It has the potential to add a tremendous amount of volatility to a market that has unbelievable weakness under the surface. Everything looks good on the plastic face, but underneath the surface of the market, there's tons of carnage taking place right now.
Yeah. And we're still in the grips of this everything bubble, you know, everything, everything's hot. You and I have discussed, none of these are specific stock recommendations for or against, of course, but you know, we've looked at those individual shares that have the tulip sort of bulbly shapes, right? And I've read all the things where people try and explain to me why it's different this time. I'm too smart and old to fall for that. I know it's never different this time. And I'm watching this in multiple different markets. So I don't wonder if this isn't, you know, the everything bubble you and I have discussed before, but we've been trying to print our way to prosperity. And as we've discussed, I really hammered Luke Roman on this in an interview, you know, both before and after the record button was hit. And like, what's the plan? That's the thing that's missing. Like, what's the plan? So if the Federal Reserve could say, oh, you know, we're just going to create this everything bubble so that if we'll hit this level of prosperity, Paul, it's just one more can kicking adventure. You know, it's just, we just can't have stocks falling today. You know, it's like never a good time, but I've searched everywhere. It's like asking somebody like who's actually running the White House and nobody can give you a definitive answer. Like we should know this. Like, what's the plan? Yeah. And it frustrates me because I watched Jerome Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, get in front of like Congress or the Senate, and nobody asks him, like, where are you going with this? Like, where does this, what comes after this? Like, how does this settle down and get us to prosperity? There's no plan. That's the problem. I don't think there's one, or they keep it real hidden. I don't know.
Well, if there is one, you know, the question is, are they backed into a corner and they're doing what they can do to survive, right? Mm-hmm. In today's society, people unfortunately are typically unwilling to admit that they made an error, unwilling to admit that they're wrong. They think it's the end of the world, but quite frankly, the smartest people I know admit that they make mistakes all the time. And so because nobody's perfect and you can't learn how to do it better unless you do make a mistake, right? So, you know, I don't know, Chris. There's, you know, is it political? I'm not sure, but I just don't see how this is sustainable. Because you take housing, for example, one of a major grumble that I'm hearing, especially because my kids are all in the age of, you know, 23 to 27 is where their friends are. They're making good livings, making really good income. Both my children are doing well for where they are. And they're like, how in the world does anybody afford to buy a house and how does anybody afford to live, right? We're at a breaking point where either house prices have to come down because still where we are today, what, 75% of the population cannot afford to buy the median home? Okay, so either house prices have to come down or incomes have to go up dramatically. Well, if incomes grow up dramatically or a combination of both, then corporate profits theoretically are going to have to come down to absorb that. And if artificial intelligence is the answer for everything, then where are the jobs going to come from to be able to provide, you know, provide those higher incomes? So something has to break. And my concern is that they're trying to kick the can down the road long enough until there's a trigger that something that happens on a global scale that they can point to and go, see, it's that fault, not ours. Right. That's my biggest concern. That's what I'm concerned about more than anything, because that makes it harder for us in a prudent in managing assets prudently and managing our resources individually to prepare correctly and in a timely manner.
So let's speaking of that house thing, because I feel bad for people in your kids, the whole generation, right? So this is a piece from Ben Hunt on X on Twitter. CNBC wrote, oh, weird. Home prices rose 2.4 times. That's 240% faster than inflation, which is understated, since the 60s, the study finds. So, wow. And, You know, Ben writes, you know, what that means is that Washington and Wall Street systematically mischaracterize and intentionally underreport the cost of living. It is not a red-blue thing. It's a power thing. 2.4 times faster than inflation. That's nuts.
It's nuts. And I wish I had the stats. I don't have it on my desk here. I'm looking real hard to see if I do. But you take the inflation-adjusted income since the 1980s. I hate to give a number, but this is just hypothetical because I can't remember exactly. It's up 60% or something like that, but the median home price is up 280-something percent, you know, right in line with that. So it was interesting what Ben Hunt said. It's a power thing. Is why they're hiding it. Maybe it is, but it's sad. It's heartbreaking because the American dream for the large majority of the generation that's up there now is completely out of reach. And the worst part is for the baby boomer generation, you know, it's hard to understand somebody else's pain unless you've walked a mile in their shoes, right? So unless you've lost a child, through an accident, you can't really understand what somebody's going through. So it's really hard for the baby boomer generation to understand what this generation's facing right now, because the thought is we just need to work harder. You need to save a little bit more. Don't get me wrong. You know, that can be the case, but the reality is the asset, the everything bubble has priced these kids out of the American dream at this point. And unless you have family that has resources that can assist you in making down payments on a home and assist you in getting through college without a massive amount of debt and assist you in getting started, you're falling further and further behind. And furthermore, if you make a mistake and you're in the middle class, it's a heck of a climb to upper middle class. And it's an even harder climb above that. You got to sacrifice a lot. But if you make a mistake and stumble, you can go from middle class to absolute lower class and homeless at the snap of a finger in today's society, especially depending upon the city you live in and the cost of living there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the boomers would say, listen, kids, just shell out the $16 for the Grateful Dead ticket, follow them around for a while, you know, it'll all sort itself out. They're like, dude, it's $2,000 to go to see Taylor Swift, totally different environment. Right.
Right.
Just, it's right. It's not where you grew up. Right. So,
yeah.
but the point, I think that, you know, that power thing, this is something I really want to impress on people because this is really important and it doesn't get enough airplay. This is not an accident. This isn't like people shrug and go, oh, why are house prices up 2.4 times? What a mystery. It's a policy. Mm-hmm. That's what angers me. Here's my Virgo coming out again, you know, from having the scales on horoscope. But it really bothers me, Paul, because it's somebody's made the decision. An unelected person has made this decision because nobody elects the FOMC. And they've said, you know, mm-hmm. on balance, we'd rather have house prices going up than not, because mm-hmm. it has a wealth effect. And we have all these papers from our internal PhDs saying this is a good thing. All you'd have to do is not be a moron or get out of your little ivory tower Princeton bubble and walk out into the street. You know, it's like getting a lecture on inflation from Paul Krugman, who last was shopping in 1943. I don't know. Right. You know, but they just like they are literally sacrificing the homeowner in the home building and the home starting, the household mm-hmm. formation of an entire generation because they have a paper that says, you know, on balance, it's better to have house prices going up than not.
Mm hmm.
And so they engineer low mortgage rates to make house prices go up and then convince you the way to get ahead is to borrow against that because it's an asset. My friend Robert Kiyosaki, he disabused me of this. He said, Chris, you know, in his book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, too, he says it very clearly. He said, Chris, an asset puts money in your pocket. A liability takes money out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. Your house. Quick. Asset or liability? Right? Clearly, it's a liability. A big one.
Yeah.
Right? If it's a rental house I own, totally different story, right? If it's cash flowing positive. But otherwise, you know, we've been sold this bill of goods that you know, that our house is an asset that we can tap for a line of credit. You peel all that away, it's just a way for you to get in deeper and deeper into debt while we're sacrificing the generation behind us because they can't even form a household. So I'm against the whole thing. I think it's short-sighted and greedy and kind of sinful. Greed. Avarice.
I, I agree completely. And there's a few simple things that could be done from a legislative standpoint to stand up and make it easier for the average American to own a home. First, don't let institutions buy residential houses. Okay.
There you go.
I mean, we don't need to be competing. Our kids don't need to be competing with the BlackRocks of the world. They just don't. Okay. Because one, they're somewhat price insensitive. Okay. People have given them money. They go in, they really don't care what they pay for it. They just want the simplest thing. So let me buy the whole neighborhood. Okay. Second thing is, you know, foreign entities coming in and buying residential homes. Like, I mean, surely there's ways that that can be done, but you've got to have a higher standard to cross. And then take some of the money that we're sending overseas and reinvest it back into our infrastructure, you know, and have, you know, I'm for being able to give tax incentives for affordable housing. I mean, I had an aunt that ran the housing authority when I was younger. Not, as far as I know, there's not housing authorities around, but they were there to be able to provide affordable homes for people that were on the low income side. So we need to be reinvesting back into our own country instead of sending all these funds overseas to try to, you know, put our woke agenda on the rest of the world. Not mine and yours, but you know what I mean.
I would go further. I would remove almost all the building codes, do this for a year, and just see how it works out, you know? And because I was reading something that said that before you even put a shovel in the ground on a lot, you're usually out close to $100,000,
mm-hmm.
right? Even before you do anything, right? Because that might be, you have to do the sewage hookup, or you've got to actually have a, you know, a septic system in, or you got to put a well in, but there's the zoning, there's the this, there's those permits, there's that, mm-hmm. you know, you haven't even built the house yet. And I was talking with a local builder and he said that, you know, it's somewhere between 250 and 400 a square foot now to put a house up, right?
Yeah.
Okay. 1,000 square foot house, which is exceedingly modest, would be somewhere, because I can do the math in my head, somewhere between $250,000 and $400,000.
That's insane. It is.
Yeah.
And you're right. The regulations that are coming through, the building codes, some of them make sense, right? Like, I get it. If you live in a neighborhood and you got a pool, it is a prudent thing for yourself and for any young kid that runs around that neighborhood to have a fence around that pool. There are people that don't like it, especially live in the country, but I think people understand that. But some of these ridiculous codes that you have out there, all those are is no different than what's happened in the halls of power with the military industrial complex. You've got lobbyists who have gone in and they've stated, you need to, you know, push this regulation through. And behind the scenes, I don't know that they give money. I hate to even go that far. I'm sure it does happen, but it's all about legislation to drive sales of products. That's what lobbyists are supposed to do. You know, and it still amazes me to this day. I grew up in the lumber business, right? My grandfather was in the lumber business. My dad and his brother owned a lumber supply at one point. So I grew up, you know, in high school stacking lumber, delivering pressure treated wood. Well, there's a family pond that had a deck that was built in 1987. Okay. 4x4s, everything that's there with all that pressure treated wood that's there. Now, I know nobody likes the pressure treated process that's out there now, but we didn't know anybody who had any issues from that process. Now, I don't know all the chemical, you know, all the other stuff behind it, but what I can tell you is that deck and those 4x4s, they're still there from 1987 to today, and you can still walk on them. Now, they're starting to rot a little bit, but, you know, the new pressure treated products, they're done, and I mean, they don't even last 5 to 6 years, and you got to replace the whole back porch. Is that really about selling more goods, which is not good for the average citizen or homeowner, or is it about protecting the environment? Somewhere there's got to be a fine balance in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there are a couple states that don't really do building codes, and I've been to those states, and everything seems to sort of stand. It's fine. Because I trust that people will not build a house that's going to fall down on their own heads. Or if they do, then it does. And that's kind of on them. Or if they go to try and sell it and it's a structural disaster, they won't be able to sell it. So these things sort themselves out anyway.
They do.
So in my state of Massachusetts, last building code upcycle, there was this many new codes added in. When I first started building, you know, because I did this as carpentry and framing during college. The whole code book was this thick, right? Mm-hmm. You have to use this, you know, 12 penny nail for this, 10 penny for that, this many per sheet of sheetrock. There weren't that many. You could learn them pretty quick. Now it's that, that's the addition. So the whole stack is like this now, you know? And, you know, they said, you know, the roofs now have to be able to withstand like these killer loads. Like you should be able to put elephants on them now because lobbyists got in or something. And it doesn't matter if you point at like these, there's roofs from the 1700s here where you go up and you look inside the attic and there's like a, literally a round, they didn't even bother shaving it down. Like they, maybe they took the bark off, but there's like a round stick, you know, and they're 4 feet on center. And somehow it worked itself out over the last 280 years. You know, I'm thinking
it was good enough to stand the test of time, right?
Yeah. Now you have to have 12 inch on center, you know, number one, you know, 8 inch, 2x8s, whatever, blah, blah, all that stuff. So,
yeah,
but it makes it all stupid expensive, obviously. And so back to this point about how it's all sort of coming to a head here, I do feel like our monetary fiscal train is just out of control right now.
Yes.
And the question is, what do you do about that? And how do you protect yourself? And I know there's a lot of questions about that. I don't have any good answers. I'm starting to investigate. So, you know, you and I have talked about the great taking a lot, and we're still working through some things around that.
Yes.
I've investigated that to within an inch of my life. I think I'm going to do the SIPC this week. And I'll be covering that so we can see what is and is not really involved there. In terms of coverage. But beyond that, it really is pretty obvious to me that there's no plan that I've determined. They're just going to keep trying to this whole thing together with spit and baling wire. And we have to get ready for what happens if things break. And I think that gold price in yen is telling me what they think about gold in Japan, right?
So sometimes while you're pulling that up, sometimes those that are searching for wisdom will have a type in shadow or something that is an indication that they can, you know, is a warning per se. So I fully believe that that is an educational chart that is a warning and showing an opportunity for a U.S. investor. But when gold and U.S. dollars completes and breaks out of, which you could argue it has already, but it's not an absolute clear break out of the cup and handle, but I believe that's coming to the United States. Not a recommendation to go buy it. You got to talk to an advisor. I'm just speaking freely for educational purposes. We don't know the future, but I believe that's coming to U.S. investors that are patient.
I agree. And I do think there's a market correction coming because of charts like this. This is a weird one for me. This is the market cap of the largest stock relative to the 75th percentile stock. And so it's just a ratio, just sort of, it's just telling you, you know, what's, you know, how concentrated is the stock market in a small share? So we've heard about the FANGs or the Magnificent Seven or whatever, but this is kind of interesting because if we look at this, and get my little laser pointer here, we're in all time brand new, like this is worse than back in the Great Depression, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, this was a peak here in 1932, another peak in 39, 1973, 2000, way worse than 2000, 2009. This is interesting. So it's just very heavily concentrated. And when you get into these concentrations, like if we see like what happened back here in the 70s, 1973, that's the Nifty 50 right there. Yeah. That's pretty equivalent. You know, there were 50 top stocks, kind of like our Magnificent Seven, the Nifty 50. So that's interesting to me because when you look at this Nifty 50 market top here, where the Dow with the Nifty 50 combined had $1,050 combined share price and collapsed back to 600. So that's a 40 plus percent loss right there is what happened after we hit that peak. So the question is, what's this peak mean relative to that peak? Is this more important or less important? Are things just different now? Is there a new era, Paul, where big companies are just the way it is?
Well,
different this time?
if it is different this time than the past century, 100 years of evidence, you can throw out the window for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So So, maybe it's bigger this time because of monetary stimulus. It'll certainly be somewhat different because they don't follow the exact pattern. Maybe we set new records in all of those metrics before this is over. I could argue that just because of the severe monetary expansion that occurred during the COVID stimulus. But the end result, I do not believe that it's different this time. And the reason is, Chris, these are human nature-driven events. Right. So we still haven't solved all of our weaknesses in our human nature. You know, we all know the older you get, don't make major decisions when you're really emotional. Right. At least count to 10 before you open your mouth. Mm-hmm. The level of speculation in the market and the lack of consequences is what occurs and leads to the tulip bubble, to the housing bubble in 07, and now the everything bubble. So I do not believe that it's different this time, because I believe that although history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. And our society doesn't value teaching history in our school system anymore. And if they do, they want to teach an alternative history. But the reality is, history is there so that we can learn from the mistakes of the past and press on to the greater achievements of the future. And if we refuse to consider the mistakes of the past, and all that does is indicate periods that were similar to this in the past, I don't think it's different this time. No, I think the pain, the longer this goes, and because there's so much speculation out there, I believe that the pain of this one is going to be enough to mark future generations for quite some time.
Well, as we're recording this, I'm seeing that, this is just crazy to me. So stop me if you've heard this one before. Fed opens mouth, stocks go spiking in response to that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just, man. It's one of these things that just has to happen. So Fed opens their mouth and just, it's just automatic at this point. That's the bubble behavior is just so ingrained. There is no other response that makes sense. You can trade this one as reliably as anything else. And what did they say? Nothing. Stood pat on rates. That's it.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, that the only thing that was noteworthy is we went from, if I remember correctly, 8 Fed governors that were expecting. So they changed the dot plots. Before, we had 8 that saw 50 bips cut, 50 basis points, or 2/4 percent point cuts in the year. Now we've got 9. So, right. So it's technically a little bit more hawkish.
9.
A little bit more hawkish. So that takes us from 3/4 point cuts. I stumbled over myself, basis points and cuts. I was caught in between. But 3/4 point cuts to 2. So from 8 to 9, no change for rates, barely any change in statement. And then the market blows out to new highs, right? Like, all they needed to do was say that they're going to give the market cuts back at the end of October. And that initiated the momentum that's feeding on itself at this point for the markets. I mean, that it's just the level of speculation and cognitive dissonance is absolutely crazy. Now, don't get me wrong.
Well,
some things are holding up better than I expected, but the markets don't justify this right now.
I don't know that they do on a fundamental basis, but Luke's point, when I asked him about this dynamic, he said, if you rotate the cube and you look at it and you say, what is the market saying? It might be saying the Fed is trapped and we know they're going to print.
Yeah.
That's it. We know they're going to have to print. So it doesn't matter whether stocks fall or climb or spike. It doesn't matter. They know what comes next. The Fed's going to have to print and print hard. Just to start this whole thing, and he was talking a 10x a balance sheet expansion, like, the Fed's balance sheet goes from $7.5 trillion to $75 trillion. Like, most people, would say, oh, that's insane. No. Any more insane than going from 4.5 to 9 trillion?
No, it's not. I mean, it's just... and the worst part is they keep doing larger amounts of the same. So, and Luke's he's a great thinker as well. And your interview with him was wonderful, by the way. And so that's one of the reasons, Chris, and this is my concern. And my working theory has been, or hypothesis, that we're going to have an accident. Markets are going to drop 30, 40, 50%. The response on the other side is going to be what cracks our currency, and that's when the real pain comes. Okay, now one of the things I have to be careful is it's a working theory, and you have to pay attention to the data and the information as you're going along. So you're always looking up and kind of looking at it and testing it and saying, okay, because it's my responsibility to help guide clients. We've got our tools that'll point us in the right direction, but I always want to ask questions, because if you get your mindset on one thing, that's probably not what's not going to happen. But I keep asking myself, when you make that comment, if these markets are to the point that, hey, the Fed's going to print anyway, so bad news is good news, good news is good news, okay, then why in the world would you want to own any other asset besides stocks? Why would you want to own treasuries? Why would you want to own money market? Why would you want to own anything else? And that's why I don't believe that these are the leading edges of hyperinflation yet, but I keep asking, you know, in hindsight, are we going to look back and go, that was the turning point? And, you know, it's foolish to bet on that right now because it's pure speculation, and it's foolish to speculate in an environment like this. You have to diversify. But I keep asking that question because why would you own anything else if these are markets that'll never go down again?
So on that front, as stocks go up, though, they get more expensive relative to earnings. And so then you get to this chart, which this one actually surprised me from the Daily Shot. They put out great charts there. This is S&P 500 forward earnings yield. So if a stock yields 3%, that's its yield, compared to the 10-year treasury yield, which is yielding right around 4.12% today. So you subtract that 10-year yield from the S&P forward earnings yield, and we're going to zero. So eventually, when it goes below zero, you're in a really weird territory where you're saying, I'd rather own stocks, even though they're not yielding as much as something that has no, the so-called risk-free asset, which is the 10-year treasury. It's the riskiest of risk-freest of assets, right? That's crazy to me. You know, you have to be fully speculative to believe that it's worth, you're holding stocks when they're negative yielding compared to bonds, because you're thinking stocks have to go up in price or earnings have to really blow out. One of these two things has to happen. Yeah.
Something has to break. And that's one of the things that John Hussman does a phenomenal job pointing out in a couple of his most recent letters. It says that basically, you know, there's a high probability treasury yields are going to outperform the market over the next 10 years. You know, so when your risk-free rate of return is greater than the earnings yield on the S&P 500, the question is why would you carry that risk? Either one, you know, there's big institutions out there that really think that we are headed into currency crisis, hyperinflationary event sooner rather than later, which I don't think that's the case. I think this is just simply herd psychology, you know, desperation and a lot of gambling on the parts of a lot of market participants and unknown gambling on the large majority of market participants that have just been caught, throw it in an unmanaged passive index and ride it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very dangerous thing to do right now.
It is. And it feels like being in a risk-free, people I don't think have, something's happened with our risk, sense of risk in the markets, not the individuals, right? It's like that scene in Men in Black. No. Persons are smart. People are a dumb, panicky animal, and you know it, right? Tommy Lee Jones says that, right? You know? So I don't know what's going on with markets, you know, because it feels like the nobody, like there's like risk is zero. We're back to that. But I've been here before, Paul. I saw this in 2000. I participated in it. I was dumb then, but I learned tuition's expensive in the bubble school. But then when I saw it come again in 2007, I knew exactly what I was looking at. It was just a different asset class. Oh, it's different this time. Chris, they're not making more land. Houses are different. I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure it's the same. We're there again.
We're there again. You know, it's interesting. So 98, 99, during that period of time, just getting started in the business, I had one of the old timers that I'm grateful for. And I try my best to be able to be a mentor for other people coming in the business too. He made the comment. He says, you don't have a lot of responsibility as you're building your business right now. He said, I do want you to pay attention, because look at the foolishness and the craziness that's taken place. And cause you're going to see an unbelievable amount of pain on the other side of this. And don't forget that, because these are cycles that repeat throughout history. And I will tell you this, I've thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. For whatever reason, my mind keeps going back to that time and the behavior that people were undertaking, the arrogance in the mainstream media investors out there. You know, that was back during a time where CNBC Jim Cramer was calling for the resignation of Warren Buffett, right? He, you know, the comment was, he's too old, he doesn't understand the new economy. So, you know, that same thing is taking place right here, but it's not just limited to tech stocks. I'm seeing it in every asset class. And that's the most concerning thing about it, because I don't, you know, there are asset classes that are underpriced right now. There are asset classes that look great. Okay. But if we get a big downturn in the market, people are going to be selling anything they can to cover the massive amount of debts that they have out there. So all asset, more than likely, all asset classes will go down together. Some will do good during recessions. There are those. Those are the ones that we want to look for. But there are a few out there right now that are long-term opportunities that are going to recover a lot quicker than everything else. So, you know, for the investor that's looking and patient and looking for the path of prudence, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for those that are ready, willing, and patient enough to make the changes that need to be made to take advantage of it.
Well, I think for a lot of people, maybe the decision's easy because they would like to have somebody else managing their money, and because it's a full contact sport. Because I think people should be working on planting a garden, buying some cows and chickens if they can put them in the space, and figuring out how to sort of batten the hatches a little and just become as self-reliant as possible. Those things all take time. So where do you want to spend your time?
That's right. Hey, speaking of planting, so Sunday is the first time ever that I've planted off the Farmer's Almanac in the lunar calendar. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I started all my seeds for my peppers, my tomatoes, and kind of like I do my chickens and my eggs, I've seeded enough to where I'm going to give them to all my friends and family that want to grow. But I had some notes on years I've had in the past, so I'm really curious, because my grandfather planted off of the Farmer's Almanac in the lunar calendar, and he had massive harvests. So I'm curious to see if it makes a difference this year.
Oh, I'm dying to know the outcome of that. Yeah. So I've never done that before. I plant when I have time, you know.
I know. Hey, it was funny because my staff were like, they came and looked at me and said, "Are you okay?" I was like, "Yeah." They were like, "You've never blocked off a day of the calendar so that you could go plant your garden. What's up with that? Like, are you really going gardening?" I said, no, seriously, I'm doing it off the lunar calendar. So I blocked it off to make sure I could go plant that day.
Oh, that's great. I'm jealous. We're not quite at the planting cycle. You're critical, 800 miles south of me, I guess, probably. So.
And I'm just seeding. So this is inside. I haven't planted them out yet. This is just getting started.
Yeah. Well, good stuff. All right. Well, Paul, thanks so much for your time again today, sir. It's good talking with you as always.
Always an honor, Chris. Always an honor.